Holding a printed catalog, Luba loofed, wearing shiny tapered pants and an illuminated gold vest-like top, stood absorbed in the picture before her. A drawing of a young girl, hands clasped together, seated on the edge of a bed, an expression of bewildered wonder and new, groping awe imprinted on the face. "Want me to buy it for you?" Rick said to Luba Luft. He stood beside her, holding laxly onto her upper arm, informing her by his loose grip that he knew he had possession of her. He did not have to strain in an effort to detain her. On the other side of her, Phil Resch put his hand on her shoulder, and Rick saw the bulge of the laser tube. Phil Resch did not intend to take chances, not after the near miss with Inspector Garland. "It's not for sale." Luba Luft glanced at him idly, then violently as she recognized him. Her eyes faded and the color dimmed from her face, leaving it cadaverous, as if already starting to decay. As if life had, in an instant, retreated to some point far inside her, leaving the body to its automatic ruin.
"I thought they arrested you."
"Do you mean they let you go?"
"Miss Luft," he said, "this is Mr. Resch. Phil Resch, this is the quite well-known opera singer Luba Luft." To Luba, he said, "The harness bull that arrested me is an android. So was his superior. Do you know? Did you know an Inspector Garland? He told me that you all came here in one ship as a group." "The police department which you called," Phil Resch said to her, "operating out of a building on Mission, is the organizing agency by which, it would appear, your group keeps in touch. They even feel confident enough to hire a human bounty hunter." "Evidently,
you,"
Luba Luft said, "you're not human. No more than I am. You're an android, too." An interval of silence passed, and then Phil Resch said in a low but controlled voice, "Well, we'll deal with that at the proper time." To Rick, he said, "Let's take her to my car." One of them on each side of her, they prodded her in the direction of the museum elevator. Luba Luft did not come willingly, but on the other hand, she did not actively resist. Seemingly, she had become resigned. Rick had seen that before in androids, in crucial situations. The artificial life force animating them seemed to fail if pressed too far. At least in some of them. But not all. And it could flare up again furiously. Androids, however, had, as he knew, an innate desire to remain inconspicuous. In the museum, with so many people roaming around, Luba Luft would tend to do nothing. The real encounter, for her probably the final one, would take place in the car, where no one else could see. Alone, with appalling abruptness, she could shed her inhibitions. He prepared himself and did not think about Phil Resch. As Resch had said, it would be dealt with at a proper time. At the end of the corridor near the elevators, a little store-like affair had been set up. It sold prints and art books, and Luba halted there, tarrying.
"Listen," she said to Rick.
Some of the color had returned to her face. Once more, she looked, at least briefly, alive.
"Buy me a reproduction of that picture I was looking at when you found me. The one of the girl sitting on the bed."
After a pause, Rick said to the clerk, a heavy-jowled, middle-aged woman with netted gray hair, "Do you have a print of Munch's Puberty?" Only in this book of his collected work, the clerk said, lifting down a handsome, glossy volume.
$25.
I'll take it. He reached for his wallet. Phil Resch said, my departmental budget could never in a million years be stretched. My own money, Rick said. He handed the woman the bills and Luba the book. Now let's get started down, he said to her and Phil Resch.
It's very nice of you,
Luba said as they entered the elevator.
There's something very strange and touching about humans. An android would never have done that.
She glanced icily at Phil Resch. It wouldn't have occurred to him. As he said, never in a million years. She continued to gaze at Resch, now with manifold hostility and aversion.
I really don't like androids. Ever since I got here from Mars, my life has consisted of imitating the human, doing what she would do, acting as if I had the thoughts and impulses a human would have. Imitating, as far as I'm concerned, a superior life form.
To Phil Resch, she said,
isn't that how it's been with you, Resch? Trying to be?
I can't take this. Phil Resch dug into his coat, groped. No, Rick said. He grabbed at Phil Resch's hand. Resch retreated, eluding him. The Benelli test, Rick said. It's admitted it's an android, Phil Resch said. We don't have to wait. But to retire it, Rick said, because it's needling you. Give me that. He struggled to pry the laser tube away from Phil Resch. The tube remained in Phil Resch's possession. Resch circled back within the cramped elevator, evading him, his attention on Luba Luft only. Okay, Rick said. Retire it. Kill it now. Show it that it's right. He saw then that Resch meant to. Wait! Phil Resch fired, and at the same instant Luba Luft, in a spasm of frantic, hunted fear, twisted and spun away, dropping as she did so. The beam missed its mark, but as Resch lowered it, burrowed a narrow hole silently into her stomach. She began to scream. She lay crouched against the wall of the elevator, screaming. Like the picture, Rick thought to himself, and with his own laser tube, killed her. Luba Luft's body fell forward, face down in a heap. It did not even tremble. With his laser tube, Rick systematically burned into blurred ash the book of pictures which he had just a few minutes ago bought Luba. He did the job thoroughly, saying nothing. Phil Resch watched without understanding, his face showing his perplexity.
You could have kept the book yourself, Resch said, when it had been done. That cost you.
Do you think androids have souls? Rick interrupted. Cocking his head on one side, Phil Resch gazed at him in even greater puzzlement. I could afford the book, Rick said. I've made $3,000 so far today, and I'm not even half through.
You're claiming Garland? Phil Resch asked.
But I killed him, not you. You just lay there. And Luba, too. I got her. You can't collect, Rick said. Not from your own department and not from ours. When we get to your car, I'll administer the Benelli test or the Voigt Kampf to you, and then we'll see. Even though you're not on my list. His hands shaking, he opened his briefcase, rummaged among the crumpled onion skin carbons. No. You're not here. So legally, I can't claim you. To make anything, I'll have to claim Luba, Luft, and Garland.
You're sure? I'm an android?
Is that really what Garland said?
That's what Garland said.
Maybe he was lying, Phil Resch said. To split us apart. As we are now. We're nuts letting them split us. You were absolutely right about Luba Luft. I shouldn't have let her get my goat like that. I must be overly sensitive. That would be natural for a bounty hunter, I suppose. You're probably the same way. But look, we would have had to retire Luba Luft anyhow, half an hour from now. Only one half hour more. She wouldn't even have had time to look through that book you got her. And I still think you shouldn't have destroyed it. That's a waste. I can't follow your reasoning. It isn't rational, that's why. Rick said, I'm getting out of this business. And go into what? Anything. Insurance underwriting, like Garland was supposed to be doing. Or I'll emigrate. Yes. He nodded. I'll go to Mars. But someone has to do this, Phil Resch pointed out. They can use androids. Much better if Andy's doing. I can't anymore. I've had enough. She was a wonderful singer. The planet could have used her. This is insane. This is necessary. Remember, they killed humans in order to get away. And if I hadn't gotten you out of the Mission police station, they would have killed you. That's what Garland wanted me for. That's why he had me come down to his office. Didn't Polakoff almost kill you? Didn't Luba Luft almost? We're acting defensively. They're here on our planet. They're murderous, illegal aliens masquerading as... As police, Rick said. As bounty hunters. Okay. Give me the Benelli test. Maybe Garland lied. I think he did. False memories just aren't that good. What about my squirrel? Yes, your squirrel. I forgot about your squirrel. If I'm an Andy, Phil Resch said, and you kill me, you can have my squirrel. Here, I'll write it out, willing it to you. Andes can't will anything. They can't possess anything to will. Then just take it, Phil Resch said. Maybe so, Rick said. The elevator had reached the first floor now. Its doors opened. You stay with Luba. I'll get a patrol car here to take her to the Hall of Justice for her bone marrow test. He saw a phone booth, entered it, dropped in a coin, and, his fingers shaking, dialed. Meanwhile, a group of people who had been waiting for the elevator gathered around Phil Resch and the body of Luba Luft. She was really a superb singer, he said to himself as he hung up the receiver, his call completed. I don't get it. How can a talent like that be a liability to our society? But it wasn't the talent, he told himself. It was she herself. As Phil Resch is, he thought. He's a menace in exactly the same way, for the same reasons. So I can't quit now. Emerging from the phone booth, he pushed his way among the people, back to Resch and the prone figure of the android girl. Someone had put a coat over her. Not Resch's. Going up to Phil Resch, who stood off to one side, vigorously smoking a small gray cigar, he said to him, I hope to God you do test out as an android.
You really hate me,
Phil Resch said, marveling.
All of a sudden.
You didn't hate me back on Mission Street. Not while I was saving your life. I see a pattern. The way you killed Garland, and then the way you killed Luba. You don't kill the way I do. You don't try to... Hell, he said. I know what it is. You like to kill. All you need is a pretext. If you had a pretext, you'd kill me. That's why you picked up on the possibility of Garland being an android. It made him available for being killed. I wonder what you're going to do when you fail to pass the Benelli test. Will you kill yourself? Sometimes androids do that. But the situation was rare.
Yes. I'll take care of it, Phil Resch said. You won't have to do anything, besides administering the test.
A patrol car arrived. Two policemen hopped out, strode up, saw the crowd of people, and at once cleared themselves a passage through. One of them recognized Rick and nodded. So we can go now, Rick realized. Our business here is concluded. Finally. As he and Resch walked back down the street to the opera house, on whose roof their hover car lay parked, Resch said, I'll give you my laser tube now, so you won't have to worry about my reaction to the test. In terms of your own personal safety. He held out the tube, and Rick accepted it. How will you kill yourself without it? Rick asked. If you fail the test.
I'll hold my breath.
Christ's sake, Rick said. It can't be done. There's no automatic cut-in of the vagus nerve, Phil Resch said, in an android, as there is in a human. Weren't you taught that when they trained you? I got taught that years ago. But to die that way, Rick protested. There's no pain. What's the matter with it? It's... He gestured, unable to find the right words. I don't really think I'm going to have to, Phil Resch said. Together they ascended to the roof of the War Memorial Opera House and Phil Resch's parked hover car. Sliding behind the wheel and closing his door, Phil Resch said, I would prefer it if you used the Benelli test. I can't. I don't know how to score it. I would have to rely on you for an interpretation of the readings, he realized. And that's out of the question.
You'll tell me the truth, won't you?
Phil Resch asked.
If I'm an android, you'll tell me.
Sure.
Because I really want to know. I have to know.
Phil Resch relit his cigar, shifted about on the bucket seat of the car, trying to make himself comfortable. Evidently, he could not.
Did you really like that Munch picture that Luba Luft was looking at? He asked. I didn't care for it. Realism in art doesn't interest me. I like Picasso and...
Puberty dates from 1894, Rick said shortly. Nothing but realism existed then. You have to take that into account.
But that other one, of the man holding his ears and yelling, that wasn't representational.
Opening his briefcase, Rick fished out his test gear.
Elaborate, Phil Resch observed, watching. How many questions do you have to ask before you can make a determination?
Six or seven. He handed the adhesive pad to Phil Resch. Attach that to your cheek. Firmly. And this light, he aimed it. This stays focused on your eye. Don't move. Keep your eyeball as steady as you can.
Reflex fluctuations, Phil Resch said acutely.
But not to the physical stimulus. You're not measuring dilation, for instance. It'll be to the verbal questions. What we call a flinch reaction.
Rick said, Do you think you can control it?
Not really. Eventually, maybe. But not the initial amplitude. That's outside conscious control. If it weren't...
He broke off.
Go ahead. I'm tense. Excuse me if I talk too much.
Talk all you want, Rick said. Talk all the way to the tomb, he said to himself, if you feel like it. It didn't matter to him.
If I test out Android, Phil Resch prattled, you'll undergo renewed faith in the human race. But since it's not going to work out that way, I suggest you begin framing an ideology which will account for...
Here's the first question, Rick said. The gear had now been set up and the needles of the two dials quivered. Reaction time is a factor, so answer as rapidly as you can. From memory, he selected an initial question. The test had begun. Afterward, Rick sat in silence for a time. Then he began gathering his gear together, stuffing it back in the briefcase.
I can tell by your face, Phil Resch said.
He exhaled in absolute, weightless, almost convulsive relief.
Okay. You can give me my gun back.
He reached out, his palm up, waiting. Evidently you were right, Rick said, about Garland's motives. Wanting to split us up.
What you said.
He felt both psychologically and physically weary.
Do you have your ideology framed? Phil Resch asked. That would explain me as part of the human race?
Rick said, There is a defect in your empathic role-taking ability. One which we don't test for. Your feelings toward androids.
Of course we don't test for that.
Maybe we should. He had never thought of it before. Had never felt any empathy on his own part toward the androids he killed. Always he had assumed that throughout his psyche he experienced the android as a clever machine, as in his conscious view. And yet, in contrast to Phil Resch, a difference had manifested itself. And he felt instinctively that he was right. Empathy toward an artificial construct? He asked himself. Something that only pretends to be alive? But Luba Luft had seemed genuinely alive. It had not worn the aspect of a simulation.
You realize, Phil Resch said quietly, what this would do. If we included androids in our range of empathic identification as we do animals,
we couldn't protect ourselves.
Absolutely. These Nexus 6 types, they'd roll all over us and mash us flat. You and I, all the bounty hunters, we stand between the Nexus 6 and mankind, a barrier which keeps the two distinct. Furthermore,
he ceased, noticing that Rick was once again hauling out his test gear.
I thought the test was over.
I want to ask myself a question, Rick said. And I want you to tell me what the needles register. Just
Give me the calibration. I can compute it. He plastered the adhesive disc against his cheek, arranged the beam of light until it fed directly into his eye. Are you ready? Watch the dials. We'll exclude time lapse in this. I just want magnitude.
Sure, Rick, Phil Resch said obligingly.
Aloud, Rick said, I'm going down an elevator with an android I've captured. And suddenly someone kills it without warning.
No particular response, Phil Resch said.
What did the needles hit?
The left one, 2.8, the right one, 3.3.
Rick said, a female android.
Now they're up to 4.0 and 6, respectively.
That's high enough, Rick said. He removed the wired adhesive disc from his cheek and shut off the beam of light.
That's an emphatically empathic response, he said. About what a human subject shows for most questions. Except for the extreme ones, such as those dealing with human pelts used decoratively. The truly pathological ones.
Meaning?
Rick said, I'm capable of feeling empathy for at least specific, certain androids. Not for all of them, but one or two. For Luba Luft, as an example, he said to himself. So I was wrong. There's nothing unnatural or unhuman about Phil Resch's reactions.
It's me.
I wonder, he wondered, if any human has ever felt this way before about an android. Of course, he reflected, this may never come up again in my work. It could be an anomaly, something, for instance, to do with my feelings for the magic flute. And for Luba's voice, in fact, her career as a whole. Certainly, this had never come up before, or at least not that he had been aware of. Not, for example, with Polakoff, nor with Garland. And, he realized, if Phil Resch had proved out android, I could have killed him without feeling anything. Anyhow, after Luba's death. So much for the distinction between authentic living humans and humanoid constructs. In that elevator at the museum, he said to himself, I rode down with two creatures, one human, the other android. And my feelings were the reverse of those intended, of those I'm accustomed to feel, am required to feel.
You're in a spot, Deckard, Phil Resch said. It seemed to amuse him.
Rick said, What should I do?
It's sex, Phil Resch said.
Sex?
Because it was physically attractive. Hasn't that ever happened to you before?
Phil Resch laughed.
We were taught that it constitutes a prime problem in bounty hunting. Don't you know, Deckard, that in the colonies they have android mistresses?
It's illegal, Rick said, knowing the law about that.
Sure, it's illegal. But most variations in sex are illegal. But people do it anyhow.
What about not sex, but love?
Love is another name for sex.
Like love of country, Rick said. Love of music.
If it's love toward a woman or an android imitation, it's sex.
Wake up and face yourself, Deckard. You wanted to go to bed with a female type of android. Nothing more, nothing less. I felt that way on one occasion, when I had just started bounty hunting. Don't let it get you down. You'll heal. What's happened is that you've got your order reversed. Don't kill her, or be present when she's killed, and then feel physically attracted. Do it the other way. Rick stared at him. Go to bed with her first, and then kill her, Phil Rash said succinctly. His grainy, hardened smile remained. You're a good bounty hunter, Rick realized. Your attitude proves it. But am I? Suddenly, for the first time in his life, he had begun to wonder. Chapter 13. Like an arc of pure fire, John R. Isidore soared across the late afternoon sky on his way home from his job. I wonder if she's still there, he said to himself. Down in that kipple-infested old apt, watching Buster Friendly on her TV set and quaking with fear every time she imagines someone coming down the hall. Including, I suppose, me. He had already stopped off at a black market grocery store. On the seat beside him, a bag of such delicacies as bean curd, ripe peaches, good, soft, evil-smelling cheese rocked back and forth as he alternately speeded up and slowed down his car. Being tense tonight, he drove somewhat erratically, and his allegedly repaired car coughed and floundered as it had been doing for months prior to overhaul. Rats, Isidore said to himself. The smell of peaches and cheese eddied about the car, filling his nose with pleasure. All rarities for which he had squandered 2 weeks' salary, borrowed in advance from Mr. Sloat. And, in addition, under the car seat where it could not roll and break, a bottle of Chablis wine knocked back and forth. The greatest rarity of all. He had been keeping it in a safety deposit box at the Bank of America, hanging on to it and not selling it no matter how much they offered, in case at some long, late, last moment a girl appeared. That had not happened, not until now. The rubbish-littered, lifeless roof of his apartment building, as always, depressed him. Passing from his car to the elevator door, he damped down his peripheral vision. He concentrated on the valuable bag and bottle which he carried, making certain that he tripped over no trash and took no ignominious pratfall to economic doom. When the elevator creakily arrived, he rode it, not to his own floor, but to the lower level on which the new tenant, Pris Stratton, now lived. Presently he stood in front of her door, rapping with the edge of the wine bottle, his heart going to pieces inside his chest.
Who's there?
Her voice, muffled by the door and yet clear, a frightened but blade-sharp tone.
This is J.R. Isidore speaking, he said briskly, adopting the new authority which she had so recently acquired via Mr. Sloat's vidphone. I have a few desirable items here, and I think we can put together a more than reasonable dinner.
The door, to a limited extent, opened. Pris, no lights on in the room behind her, peered out into the dim hall.
You sound different, she said. More grown up.
I had a few routine matters to deal with during business hours today.
The usual.
If you could let me in,
you'd talk about them.
However, she held the door open wide enough for him to enter. And then,
Seeing what he carried, she exclaimed. Her face ignited with elfin, exuberant glee. But almost at once, without warning, a lethal bitterness crossed her features, set concrete-like in place. The glee had gone. "What is it?" he said. He carried the packages and bottle to the kitchen, set them down, and hurried back. Tonelessly, Pris said, "They're wasted on me."
"Why?"
"Oh." She shrugged, walking aimlessly away, her hands in the pockets of her heavy, rather old-fashioned skirt.
"Sometime I'll tell you."
She raised her eyes then.
"It was nice of you, anyhow. Now I wish you'd leave. I don't feel like seeing anyone."
In a vague fashion, she moved toward the door to the hall. Her steps dragged, and she seemed depleted, her store of energy fading almost out.
"I know what's the matter with you," he said.
"Oh?" Her voice, as she reopened the hall door, dropped even further into uselessness, listless and barren.
"You don't have any friends.
You're a lot worse than when I saw you this morning."
"It's because I have friends."
Sudden authority stiffened her voice. She palpably regained vigor.
"Or I had. 7 of them.
That was to start with, but now the bounty hunters have had time to get to work.
So some of them, maybe all of them, are dead."
She wandered toward the window, gazed out at the blackness and the few lights here and there.
"I may be the only one of the 8 of us left. So maybe you're right."
"What's a bounty hunter?"
"That's right. You people aren't supposed to know. A bounty hunter is a professional murderer who's given a list of those he's supposed to kill. He's paid a sum, $1,000 is the going rate, I understand, for each he gets. Usually he has a contract with a city, so he draws a salary as well. But they keep that low so he'll have incentive."
"Are you sure?" Isidore asked.
"Yes."
She nodded. "You mean, am I sure he has incentive?"
"Yes, he has incentive. He enjoys it."
"I think," Isidore said, "you're mistaken." Never in his life had he heard of such a thing. Buster Friendly, for instance, had never mentioned it. "It's not in accord with present-day Mercerian ethics," he pointed out. "All life is one. No man is an island, as Shakespeare said in olden times."
"John Donne."
Isidore gestured in agitation. "That's worse than anything I ever heard of. Can't you call the police?"
"No."
"And they're after you? They're apt to come here and kill you?" He understood now why the girl acted in so secretive a fashion.
"No wonder you're scared and don't want to see anybody."
But, he thought, it must be a delusion. She must be psychotic, with delusions of persecution. Maybe from brain damage due to the dust. Maybe she's a special. "I'll get them first," he said.
"With what?"
Faintly, she smiled. She showed her small, even white teeth. "I'll get a license to carry a laser beam. It's easy to get, out here where there's hardly anybody. The police don't patrol. You're expected to watch out for yourself."
"How about when you're at work?"
I'll take a leave of absence.
Pris said, That's very nice of you, J.R. Isidore. But if bounty hunters got the others, got Max Polakoff and Garland and Luba and Hasking and Roy Batty, she broke off. Roy and Irmgard Batty. If they're dead, then it really doesn't matter. They're my best friends.
Why the hell don't I hear from them, I wonder?
She cursed angrily. Making his way into the kitchen, he got down dusty, long unused plates and bowls and glasses. He began washing them in the sink, running the rusty hot water until it cleared at last. Presently, Pris appeared, seated herself at the table. He uncorked the bottle of Chablis, divided the peaches and the cheese and the bean curd.
What's that white stuff?
Not the cheese. She pointed.
Made from soybean whey. I wish I had some...
He broke off, flushing.
It used to be eaten with beef gravy.
An android, Pris murmured. That's the sort of slip an android makes. That's what gives it away. She came over, stood beside him, and then, to his stunned surprise, put her arm around his waist and, for an instant, pressed against him.
I'll try a slice of peach, she said,
and gingerly picked out a slippery, pink-orange furry slice with her long fingers. And then, as she ate the slice of peach, she began to cry. Cold tears descended her cheeks, splashed on the bosom of her dress. He did not know what to do, so he continued dividing the food.
God damn it, she said furiously.
Well, she moved away from him, paced slowly, with measured steps about the room.
See, we lived on Mars. That's how come I know androids.
Her voice shook, but she managed to continue. Obviously, it meant a great deal to her to have someone to talk to. And the only people on Earth that you know, Isidore said, are your fellow ex-emigrants.
We knew each other before the trip. A settlement near New York. Roy Batty and Irmgard ran a drugstore. He was a pharmacist, and she handled the beauty aids, the creams and ointments. On Mars, they use a lot of skin conditioners.
She hesitated. I got various drugs from Roy. I needed them at first because... Well, anyhow, it's an awful place.
This.
She swept in the room, the apartment, in one violent gesture.
This is nothing. You think I'm suffering because I'm lonely.
Hell, all Mars is lonely. Much worse than this.
Don't the androids keep you company? I heard a commercial on...
Seating himself, he ate, and presently she, too, picked up the glass of wine. She sipped expressionlessly.
I understood that the androids helped.
The androids, she said, are lonely, too.
Do you like the wine?
She set down her glass.
It's fine.
It's the only bottle I've seen in 3 years.
We came back, Pris said, because nobody should have to live there. It wasn't conceived for habitation, at least not within the last billion years. It's so old. You feel it in the stones, the terrible old age.
Anyhow, at first, I got drugs from Roy. I lived for that new synthetic painkiller, that selenazine. And then I met Horst Hartmann, who at that time ran a stamp store, rare postage stamps. There's so much time on your hands that you've got to have a hobby, something you can pore over endlessly. And Horst got me interested in pre-colonial fiction.
You mean old books?
Stories written before space travel, but about space travel.
How could there have been stories about space travel before?
The writers, Pris said, made it up.
Based on what?
On imagination. A lot of times they turned out wrong. For example, they wrote about Venus being a jungle paradise with huge monsters and women in breastplates that glistened.
She eyed him.
Does that interest you? Big women with long braided blonde hair and gleaming breastplates the size of melons?
No, he said. Irmgard is blonde, Pris said, but small.
Anyhow, there's a fortune to be made in smuggling pre-colonial fiction, the old magazines and books and films, to Mars. Nothing is as exciting. To read about cities and huge industrial enterprises and really successful colonization. You can imagine what it might have been like. What Mars ought to be like. Canals.
Canals? Dimly, he remembered reading about that. In the olden days, they had believed in canals on Mars.
Crisscrossing the planet, Pris said. And beings from other stars, with infinite wisdom. And stories about Earth set in our time and even later, where there's no radioactive dust.
I would think, Isidore said, it would make you feel worse.
It doesn't, Pris said curtly.
Did you bring any of that pre-colonial reading material back with you? It occurred to him that he ought to try some.
It's worthless here, because here on Earth the craze never caught on. Anyhow, there's plenty here, in the libraries. That's where we get all of ours. Stolen from libraries here on Earth and shot by auto rocket to Mars. You're out at night bumbling across the open space, and all of a sudden you see a flare, and there's a rocket cracked open with old pre-colonial fiction magazines spilling out everywhere. A fortune. But of course you read them before you sell them.
She warmed to her topic.
Of all?
A knock sounded on the hall door. Ashen, Pris whispered,
I can't go. Don't make any noise. Just sit.
She strained, listening.
I wonder if the door's locked,
she said, almost inaudibly.
God, I hope so.
Her eyes, wild and powerful, fixed themselves beseechingly on him, as if praying to him to make it true. A far-off voice from the hall called, Pris, are you in there? A man's voice. It's Roy and Irmgard. We got your card. Rising and going into the bedroom, Pris reappeared carrying a pen and scrap of paper. She reseated herself, scratched out a hasty message.
You go to the door.
Isidore, nervously, took the pen from her and wrote,
And say what?
With anger, Pris scratched out,
See if it's really them.
Getting up, He walked glumly into the living room.
How would I know if it was them?
He inquired of himself. He opened the door. Two people stood in the dim hall, a small woman, lovely in the manner of Greta Garbo, with blue eyes and yellow blonde hair. The man, larger, with intelligent eyes but flat Mongolian features which gave him a brutal look. The woman wore a fashionable wrap, high shiny boots, and tapered pants. The man lounged in a rumpled shirt and stained trousers, giving an air of almost deliberate vulgarity. He smiled at Isidore, but his bright, small eyes remained oblique.
"We're looking," the small blonde woman began, but then she saw past Isidore.
Her face dissolved in rapture, and she whisked past him, calling, "Pris! How are you?" Isidore turned. The two women were embracing. He stepped aside, and Roy Batty entered, somber and large, smiling his crooked, tuneless smile. Chapter 14.
"Can we talk?" Roy said, indicating Isidore.
Pris, vibrant with bliss, said,
"It's okay, up to a point."
To Isidore, she said,
"Excuse us."
She led the baddies off to one side and muttered at them. Then the three of them returned to confront J.R. Isidore, who felt uncomfortable and out of place.
"This is Mr. Isidore," Pris said. "He's taking care of me."
The words came out tinged with an almost malicious sarcasm. Isidore blinked.
"See? He brought me some natural food."
"Food?" Ermgard Batty echoed, and trotted lithely into the kitchen to see.
"Peaches," she said,
immediately picking up a bowl and spoon. Smiling at Isidore, she ate with brisk little animal bites. Her smile, different from Pris's, provided simple warmth. It had no veiled overtones. Going after her, he felt attracted to her. Isidore said,
"You're from Mars."
"Yes, we gave up."
Her voice bobbed as, with birdish acumen, her blue eyes sparkled at him.
"What an awful building you live in. Nobody else lives here, do they? We didn't see any other lights."
"I live upstairs," Isidore said.
"Oh, I thought you and Pris were maybe living together."
Ermgard Batty did not sound disapproving. She meant it, obviously, as merely a statement. Dourly, but still smiling his smile, Roy Batty said,
"Well,
they got Polakoff." The joy which had appeared on Pris's face at seeing her friends at once melted away.
"Who else?"
"They got Garland," Roy Batty said. "They got Anders and Gitchell, and then just a little earlier today they got Lupa." He delivered the news as if, perversely, it pleased him to be telling this. As if he derived pleasure from Pris's shock.
"I didn't think they'd get Luba.
Remember, I kept saying that during the trip?"
"So that leaves," Pris said.
"The three of us,"
Ermgard said with apprehensive urgency. "That's why we're here." Roy Batty's voice boomed out with new, unexpected warmth. The worse the situation, the more he seemed to enjoy it. Isidore could not fathom him in the slightest.
"Oh, God,"
Pris said, stricken.
"Well, they had this investigator, this bounty hunter,"
Ermgard said in agitation,
named Dave Holden.
Her lips dripped venom at the name.
And then Polakoff almost got him.
Almost got him, Roy echoed, his smile now immense.
So he's in this hospital, this Holden, Ermgard continued. And evidently they gave his list to another bounty hunter, and Polakoff almost got him too. But it wound up with him retiring Polakoff. And then he went after Luba. We know that because she managed to get hold of Garland, and he sent out someone to capture the bounty hunter and take him to the Mission Street building. See, Luba called us after Garland's agent picked up the bounty hunter. She was sure it would be okay. She was sure that Garland would kill him.
She added,
but evidently something went wrong on mission. We don't know what. Maybe we never will.
Pris asked,
does this bounty hunter have our names? Oh, yes, dear, I suppose he does,
Ermgard said.
But he doesn't know where we are. Roy and I aren't going back to our apartment. We have as much stuff in our car as we could cram in, and we've decided to take one of these abandoned apartments in this ratty old building.
Is that wise? Isidore spoke up, summoning courage.
To all be in one place? Well, they got everybody else,
Ermgard said matter-of-factly. She, too, like her husband, seemed strangely resigned, despite her superficial agitation.
All of them, Isidore thought. They're all strange.
He sensed it without being able to finger it, as if a peculiar and malign abstractness pervaded their mental processes. Except, perhaps, for Pris. Certainly, she was radically frightened. Pris seemed almost right, almost natural. But
why don't you move in with him?
Roy said to Pris, indicating Isidore. He could give you a certain amount of protection.
A chicken head?
Pris said.
I'm not going to live with a chicken head.
Her nostrils flared. Ermgard said rapidly,
I think you're foolish to be a snob at a time like this. Bounty hunters move fast. He may try to tie it up this evening. There may be a bonus in it for him if he got it done by...
Christ, close the hall door, Roy said, going over to it. He slammed it with one blow of his hand, thereupon summarily locking it. I think you should move in with Isidore, Pris, and I think Erm and I should be here in the same building.
That way, we can help each other.
I've got some electronic components in my car, junk I ripped off the ship. I'll install a two-way bug so, Pris, you can hear us and we can hear you, and I'll rig up an alarm system that any of the four of us can set off. It's obvious that the synthetic identities didn't work out, even Garland's. Of course, Garland put his head in the noose by bringing the bounty hunter to the Mission Street building. That was a mistake. And Polakoff, instead of staying as far away as possible from the hunter, chose to approach him.
We won't do that.
We'll stay put. He did not sound worried in the slightest. The situation seemed to rouse him to crackling, near manic energy.
I think...
He sucked in his breath noisily, holding the attention of everyone else in the room, including Isidore.
I think that there's a reason why the three of us are still alive.
I think if he had any clue as to where we are, he'd have shown up here by now. The whole idea in bounty hunting is to work as fast as hell. That's where the profit comes.
And if he waits, Ermgard said in agreement, we slip away, like we've done. I bet Roy is right. I bet he has our names but no location. Poor Luba. Stuck in the War Memorial Opera House, right out in the open. No difficulty finding her.
Well, Roy said stiltedly, she wanted it that way. She believed she'd be safer as a public figure.
You told her otherwise, Ermgard said.
Yes, Roy agreed. I told her. And I told Polakoff not to try to pass himself off as a WPO man. And I told Garland that one of his own bounty hunters would get him, which is very possibly, just conceivably, exactly what did happen. He rocked back and forth on his heavy heels, his face wise with profundity. Isidore spoke up.
I gather from listening to Mr. Batty that he's your natural leader.
Oh, yes. Roy's a leader, Ermgard said.
Pris said he organized our trip from Mars to here.
Then, Isidore said,
you better do what he suggests.
His voice broke with hope and tension.
I think it would be terrific, Pris, if you lived with me. I'll stay home a couple of days from my job. I have a vacation coming. To make sure you're okay.
And maybe Milt, who was very inventive, could design a weapon for him to use. Something imaginative, which would slay bounty hunters, whatever they were. He had an indistinct, glimpsed darkly impression of something merciless that carried a printed list and a gun that moved machine-like through the flat, bureaucratic job of killing. A thing without emotions or even a face. A thing that, if killed, got replaced immediately by another resembling it. And so on, until everyone real and alive had been shot.
Incredible, he thought, that the police can't do anything. I can't believe that. These people must have done something.
Perhaps they emigrated back to Earth illegally.
We're told, the TV tells us, to report any landing of a ship outside the approved pads.
The police must be watching for this. But even so, no one got killed deliberately anymore. It ran contrary to Mercerism.
The chicken head, Pris said. Likes me.
Don't call him that, Pris, Ermgard said. She gave Isidore a look of compassion.
Think what he could call you.
Pris said nothing. Her expression became enigmatic. I'll go start rigging up the bug, Roy said. Ermgard and I'll stay in this apartment. Pris, you go with Mr. Isidore. He started toward the door, striding with amazing speed for a man so heavy. In a blur, he disappeared out the door, which banged back as he flung it open. Isidore, then, had a momentary, strange hallucination. He saw briefly a frame of metal, a platform of pulleys and circuits and batteries and turrets and gears.
and then the slovenly shape of Roy Batty faded back into view. Isidore felt a laugh rise up inside him. He nervously choked it off and felt bewildered.
A man, Pris said distantly, of action.
Too bad he's so poor with his hands, doing mechanical things.
If we get saved, Ermgard said in a scolding, severe tone, as if chiding her, it'll be because of Roy.
But it is worth it, Pris said, mostly to herself. She shrugged, then nodded to Isidore.
Okay, J.R. I'll move in with you, and you can protect me.
All of you, Isidore said immediately. Solemnly, in a formal little voice, Ermgard Batty said to him,
I want you to know we appreciate it very much, Mr. Isidore. You're the first friend I think any of us have found here on Earth. It's very nice of you, and maybe sometime we can repay you.
She glided over to pat him on the arm.
Do you have any pre-colonial fiction I could read? He asked her. Pardon?
Ermgard Batty glanced inquiringly at Pris.
Those old magazines, Pris said.
She had gathered a few things together to take with her, and Isidore lifted the bundle from her arms, feeling the glow that comes only from satisfaction at a goal achieved.
No, J.R. We didn't bring any back with us, for reasons I explained.
I'll go to a library tomorrow, he said, going out into the hall, and get you and me, too, some to read, so you'll have something to do besides just waiting.